microphones and make a podcast. Two microphones and you make a podcast.
Hi, this is Joyce.
And this is Mary Beth.
Welcome to the Modern Yoga Podcast. Today's guest is Josh Stacker. Am I saying that right, Josh?
Stacker. S-T-A-C-K-E-R.
But today's special guest is Josh Stacker. Is that how you are in our... Now I have to look you up.
No,
I thought were calling him Stacker because he's a guy with a mustache. Not really a mustache. Just a little facial hair.
So it is S-T-A-C-H-E-R. That's how it's spelled, but it's pronounced Stacker.
Got it.
Like
it's Anglified German.
Got it. Well, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
We are interested in hearing your story because Josh is in teacher training. You started teacher training Late April. Okay. And you're a good way through it. I'm guessing that you are most likely going to be the next one to graduate.
The next one to take that jump in your picture.
Yes. Have you practiced your jump?
I have not.
Did you see Joe's jump?
I'm not 23, so that's
right. That jump is going to be a little difficult to compete with.
I was thinking like a really solid warrior two.
You do you. You do you, boo.
Can make that warrior two float. So we've gotten to know you a little bit better during teacher training and
getting to know you. Sorry, I was just providing like the soundtrack of the back. Getting to know all about you.
Josh is very interesting. He has been practicing yoga for a while. How long has it been?
I started practice. Well, so I was playing around with yoga in the fall of 2019 at the Brecksville Community Center rec. But I was not really consistent, and like I knew there was something there, but I didn't quite know what. And then it just kind of ended, and the pandemic started, and I started like a home practice in May of 2020. And then I think I started going to a studio in May of 2021.
Oh, wow.
And then I started coming to Modern Yoga in January of 2023. So it's been about 3.5 years.
Wow. It's significant that you did a home practice at all. I mean, that takes people a lot of time. Like you really have to kind of have the yoga bug a little bit to do a home practice.
I mean, my origin story is that one of my best friend, he teaches Arabic literature at Georgetown. He called me. I don't even know what day it was, but like just a random Tuesday in the middle of the lockdown pandemic. And I thought I was just being normal. And he was like, "Are you okay? You seem a little edgy." And I said, "Oh, I'm fine." He was like, "Would you want to meditate with me?" I was like, "I don't know what you're saying to me. What do you mean?" So he explained it to me. And he said, "Look, I'll call you in like 3 hours. Be ready to sit for 10 minutes.
Wow.
So we did that. And it was pretty excruciating. And I didn't like it.
That's the word for the first meditation. Thank you.
But like, I was sort of, I knew there was something, a thread there that I had to pull a little bit. And eventually, I can get kind of addicted to things. And so I like discipline. I like things being daily practices. So I was starting to meditate a good bit. And I couldn't sit for very long because my body would cramp or be sore or this and that. So then I Googled like, well, how do people sit in meditation longer? And I found out like, well, there's a bunch of yoga. And it was about this time there was a New York Times article on Adrian Mishler and yoga with Adrian.
Yes.
And so I turned that on. And I mean, she was just like a gateway drug because mm-hmm. I Love mean, her. Like how she teaches, There's never any music. So you have to focus on your experience. I always would tell like my wife and like family members, like, I feel like I'm in a love cave. Like, just me and her, like, and she's just guiding that experience. And along the way I was reading and I was watching documentaries and I was, you know, very sort of interested in like yoga. So when it came time in 2021, I chose a studio and I went and I was there for 18 months and it was amazing.
And how did you find the studio experience after what you had been doing?
So
was it positive or was it like, where's my cave with Adrian?
So, I was like online looking and, I found this yoga studio called Daybreak Yoga. It was in Bedford, Ohio. And, you know, they all have books, like books that are important to this studio or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the book All About Love by Bell Hooks was on there. And like, that was my book. Like, that was the book that like was the turnaround in my life. And so like I knew there was a good ethos there. So I went there and at the time, it was the only solo Black woman-owned yoga studio in Ohio. And the clientele was mainly African-American women in their 50s and 60s, and then a bunch of African-American women in their 20s who were basically like nurses and first responders and these sorts of things. Wow. And like what I saw was like these people had just been chewed up by like a machine, right? Like they were spent. So I was the only white guy that practiced at Daybreak Yoga. There was only one other gentleman. His name was Brother Gary. He's like in his 60s. He would only come to the restorative class. Mm-hmm. And I practiced 5 days a week. I mean, my schedule is always the same. It's 9:30 Monday through Friday. And then I'm with my family doing wherever they're taking me. So Daybreak was great because it was about the yoga, but it was also about the very sort of particular ways that collections of Black women heal in this country because of all the barriers that they come up against, right? Mm-hmm. And at that time, I needed healing. And so once I got comfortable and everybody got comfortable, like, they just included me in like the healing sort of vibe of the whole place. Mm. So, I mean, it was a pretty amazing experience. I never had a teacher that was white. All the teachers were people of color. All of them were women. So it was just a different world in a lot of ways. I had never done power yoga. I had never done hot yoga. I wasn't even quite sure I liked it. But when Daybreak was shutting down, I was looking online and the first thing I noticed was that like, oh, modern yoga is 1.1 miles from my house. So that was attractive. And so I initially got like a student special and I went to a slow flow class first because I was like, you know, I'm not sure I'm down with all this hot power stuff. It's a bit much, right?
Was it not heated at Daybreak?
No, okay. Not heated. And so, you know, I was in the slow flow class and there was a hot class running like concurrently. And like, I was like looking at the people coming out of that class. I've done enough yoga that I can probably survive a hot power class. Like, let me give this a shot. And then I think I've been to maybe three other slow flow classes since January. And one of them was like YTT related. So, you know.
Yeah, you got the bug.
I did get the bug. And
what an interesting experience as a white male to be a minority like that. How cool, because, we think we know what that feels like. because we might walk into a, I don't know, the subway or something once and feel like we're out of place. But that's what minorities feel like all the time.
And like, it, you know, even to have this kind of like relationship or interaction, like required work, right? Like I couldn't roll out of bed and like zoom down to like, you know, like a really well-resourced yoga, you know, studio, right? It was like you had to drive there. There was no really highway access. There was like a drink shop, like a bottle shop that was operating like the next door over. So like there'd be people like completely like zooming out on yoga, and like across the plane, across the pane of glass, there were people completely zoning out on alcohol. You know, and, you know, it was just, it was a lot more. And then as just a regular customer of the business, right? Like things happen,
right?
Man, things happen a lot over there. And like resolving the problems just aren't something that are part of my experience. Usually I call, it might take a little while. I might have to beg and plead, but like things get done. Mm-hmm. Whereas there, like, you know, I mean, a lot of it just seemed cruel. Like I think it was Spotify. I can't remember, but they started coming after her because she was recording the yoga and like, what about the rights to the songs? And like, I mean, and it just was like so aggressive.
Like one thing after the other, after the other.
Exactly. You know, and so, you know, but it was an amazing experience, and I got to be part of the community. But, you know, look, for what I do for a living, I'm a college professor and I teach international studies. And so I actually lived in Cairo, Egypt for 9 years between 1998 and 2007. So I got very used to being like the only white guy in the room. And it taught me like how to listen a little better. It taught me how to like value and believe others' experiences from like the jump. Like they don't have to prove it to me. Right.
Right. Right.
And then, you know, I've been at Kent State University for 16 years, going on year 16. I'm as promoted as you can get on a university campus. And so I have a lot of freedom to teach how I like to teach, how I want to teach. And so one of the things that we do is I just use the classroom as like a way that they can experience the world with their bodies and minds. And also sort of like, what are the best ideas out there? Like, if you want to have like a violent political revolution, like who's written the best thing on that? And like, what are they saying? And like, what do we think about that? Or, you know, maybe we read something by Martin Luther King, like Pilgrimage to Nonviolence. And we say like, are you a violent person? Right. And you make people kind of confronted at that level. And then, you know, some of the other classes I teach at Kent State or Palestine and Israel, which causes just enormous headaches for a lot of people around me. It doesn't really cause me the headache because my students know exactly like who I am and what we're doing and why we're doing it. And then because I'm always sort of taking a mirror and reflecting it off them, like, well, okay, is it moral to support a two-tiered legal system in the West Bank and East Jerusalem? I mean, like, you know, it's almost ridiculous. You have to ask the question.
It's so important, though, and very cool, because I went to college not until I was in my 40s and you know, just sailing through life, doing my thing. And to be sitting in the middle of other people's problems that never affected me, I never had to pay attention to. And then to have really good professors make us talk about it was just, I'm so changed. It's ridiculous. I'm not saying I'm even better or worse, but wow.
Isn't
what
it
I was missing.
Unfortunate. Maybe this is the new modern yoga club, that we don't continue to have those conversations in safe spaces.
Where are the safe spaces?
Right. Where are the
safe spaces? We can create them.
We can create them. And I have space. Like, and so then it becomes, and this is a something that comes up in my life a lot. Why not? Right? Like, if I can help, why wouldn't I? And so maybe this podcast will lead us into international discussions with Josh Stacker.
Well, Josh, I mean, go ahead.
The other thing is, like, this is yoga. There's no difference between what's happening on our mat in our individual experience to one, the collective of people breathing together and healing together in a room. And then, like, how do we take that into our streets? And so, you know, I happen to have access also to space, like classrooms, like, mm-hmm. and look, the state of Ohio may one day completely gut our universities, and they look like they want to flirt in this direction a good bit. But for the time being, I am the king of the castle of my classroom. I control everything that goes on in it. I control the learning experience. I control the level of equality, equity, and sort of diversity of my syllabi. And this is tremendous power. And what my students have learned since we've gotten off of line and back into sort of a classroom setting is that the value of, like, a regularly scheduled sort of conversation with, like, a temporary community that sort of forms, holds together for 3 months, and then exhales out of existence, right? So
that's cool, because it takes some pressure off to know this is a temporary thing. And I liked what you said about it being a scheduled, you know, it's not just this vaporous, let's get together in a safe space and talk and learn. This is like, here's the plan. You could see the end. You could see the end of the tunnel if you don't like it. And if you do like it, a lot could change. I was about to ask you, given, you know, where you've lived and what you've done, and so the authenticity you've experienced of other cultures, how do you feel with this modern, pun intended and unintended, yoga, this Western yoga, and the idea of it, you know, being cultural appropriation?
I understand sort of the yoga that we're practicing as a sort of expression of our contemporary present. I don't think that we can go back and practice the yoga of 1,000 years ago or 1,500 years ago, although those histories and legacies endure. And so there are these connections, and I believe everything in the on planet is mutually interconnected. So I think that it's completely fine to kind of practice yoga in the way that we do. And that's essentially incredibly democratic and sort of equality bound, right? So, like, if you want to use yoga as a workout and not connect your breath and your rhythm, like, that is your business. Like, have fun with that. Enjoy. If you want to come in and just breathe and, like, move a little bit, like, that's cool. And if this is something that is taking you to some sort of supreme ultimate reality and you're accessing that through your breath and movement, like, also amazing, right? I mean, I think yoga communities have everybody in them, part of being a yogi is being honest and truthful about what we see around us. But in terms of, like, a cultural appropriation, I brought this up a little bit in one of the YTTs. I'm sort of uncomfortable saying namaste at the end. And the reason that I'm uncomfortable at this stage is because there are a lot of people from South Asian descent that are basically pointing to the issue, and I don't have, like, immediate recognition or understanding of it. And so I'm waiting to hear the arguments get articulated a little bit more before I kind of make a big decision. But generally speaking, like, the stuff that South Asians point to, like, namaste is something really formal. You would say it at the beginning. You would never say it at the end. I that needs to be cleared up for me to feel comfortable with it. That's not to say I won't use some Sanskrit words as poses and all the rest of that stuff, but I think that part, when it gets used out of context.
Yeah, right. Well, that's like, good.
I mean, there's some things that we say, you know, like, that wouldn't make any sense if we said them in English. Like, we finish a yoga class and like everybody looks at each other and I'm like, greetings.
Right. Well, I can tell you, when I was in Nepal, namaste was very informal, like hello, goodbye. You heard it all the time. Like namaste, namaste, coming in, going out. And I always look at it like what the translation is. The light, the translation is actually the divine light in me. Season honors the divine light in you. James and I at least purposely leave out the word divine because we feel like that may just press some buttons for some people. And is it 100% necessary there? Probably not. But there I am making my own decisions on a word from another language, right? Mm-hmm. And so just the expression, the light in me sees and honors that same light in you. I mean, that's so beautiful. And that's what I'm meaning, but I'm not disagreeing with you either. Like, I totally
100%. I think it's incredibly beautiful, the sentiment and the sort of literal meaning, but like people don't use words in their literal meaning. I mean, it used to drive me crazy in Egypt whenever I'd say like, I'm just going to run down to the grocery store and somebody would say, inshallah, God willing, like, no, dude, I'm just going to the grocery store. God has nothing to do with it. But like, it doesn't mean God willing. It means like
it's a context thing. And if you think about our own language, the things that we say, I often will hear something that we say every day. And I'm like, if I was just learning this language, I'd be like, what? So I see what you're saying. I used to have a wonderful teacher who ended class by saying Jai Bhagwan, that I think was victory to the light or something like that. Again, I don't really know the context, but it's also kind of odd that we often burst into applause at the end of a power yoga class.
Or the end of any class.
So, yeah. I mean, back to like the beautiful words, like we have power to make beautiful words, right? I mean, I like to finish, I think how I want to finish my yoga classes is something along the lines like, may you be happy, may you be whole, may you be free.
Like, Loka Samasta Suki no Bhavantu. Isn't that may all beings be?
Yeah. But like, but I'm saying it like directly. There's no misunderstanding.
Your way.
I'm trying to tell you. And, you know, I think I like that for right now. Yeah. I mean, I'm open to whatever. There's just enough people pushing back on it that like, there's something there, even, you know, and I haven't really seen a counter argument other than like, we're honoring like the Indian heritage and like.
Right. Well, like,
but that's your job as an educator, that which is so great to just push back a little and be like, let's see, can I poke a hole in this?
I like clarity. Right. And so I like to kind of poke holes at what we're making assumptions about so that we understand if we're acting like in congruence with our values and our passions and.
Well, isn't that what the practice is though, is to really take a look at what you're doing. Yeah. And physical poses are tools to sort of take a look at what you're doing in your body, but that never stops there. And it makes you start to take a look at the meanings of words and the meaning of the expression, like your internal meaning. And it just goes in all these different places. I really like how you described modern yoga, not meaning modern yoga, our studio, but this practice, like we are not doing yoga of 1,000 years ago or 1500 years ago, because we are in 2023 and we are in the West. We're not in the East.
I wrote down his way, expression of our contemporary present.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's such a perfect way to describe this. Yeah. And we certainly have respect and honor for those practices. But 100%. I think that if we tried to emulate or repeat those practices, it would be dishonoring, and it would be doing a disservice to us because it's not 1500 years ago, it's right now. Mm-hmm. And I also really appreciate the way that you described the power of decision making that a student has on their mat. And you were specifically talking about power yoga. You know, if somebody wants to just sit and breathe, or if they want to do an exercise, that's fine. If they want to do everything, that's great. If they don't, that's okay too. It's really tuning into honoring yourself. And I get frustrated isn't the right word. Sometimes I'm at a loss for explaining exactly this to people who call and they're so fearful of being out of place or looked at, like, I don't want anyone to laugh at me. I've never done this before. I don't want to feel uncomfortable. And it's hard to explain to somebody who's already decided in a sense that they're going to be uncomfortable, that uncomfortable is okay. It's actually a gift. It's something that you can work with.
It is. It's so difficult to explain because you try and say in these few words on the phone,
right?
You don't have to do all of these things. Well, now that you said I don't have to, it makes me feel like I can't, and I'll look, or they think that all of our classes are in some sort of continuum.
Yes.
Which is actually not the case. I mean, there's
but it also people that
can't do slow flow or think they can't because of its slowness, right, or patience or holding or lack of momentum or whatever it is.
And it's really, there's a huge reflection on our society that there's this expectation that if I am not immediately good at something, I'm going to be shamed and I'm going to feel bad about myself.
Yeah.
And I don't want to feel that way because most likely I'm used to feeling that way other ways, other places in my life. And it's also very clear that people need reinforcement, positive reinforcement, just like my granddaughter does, you know, big and little, like you are such a great little girl. You are so smart. That kind of thing too, in adult language, and sometimes not even in adult language. It can be so simple. We don't get that in our day-to-day life. And we don't get, it's like such an unusual and odd thing to be given your power back. Like this is your mat, your body, your practice, your decision.
And
I'm not judging your decision. And even if I am judging your decision, that's none of your business. Like, not in a, you know, that's my problem.
Yeah.
I'm the jerk if I throw judgment at you.
I believe that's why sometimes it's so easy for people to get emotional in a yoga class, is because when they are given that freedom and power, but then God forbid somebody also is saying nice words to you or maybe respectfully touching you with, you know, it just feels good. Like, they lose it because we don't treat each other or ourselves that sweetly and kindly on the daily.
And so all these bigger cultural, worldly issues that you're touching on, like, we're practicing, like you said, Josh, we're practicing that on our mat. Like, that's where it starts. And if we don't have a place to reflect on ourselves, to sit down and really look at what's going on, how can we do that fairly to bigger issues?
So this kind of like leads into sort of like, well, how did I get there anyway, right? So
yeah.
I mean, I grew up, looking back on it now, like, with definitely some kind of complex PTSD, where it was kind of woven into everything and all my relationships with my sister, with my parents, most of the relationships I had with friends and sort of romantic partners and that kind of stuff. And I just started to notice about every 4 or 5 years when I was younger, like, everything would just kind of collapse. All my relationships would collapse and I would almost have to remake, right, myself. And so, you know, that happens in high school. It happened in college. And by the end of college, I knew there was something kind of desperately wrong. Like, I knew that the rules that were kind of set up in the society that were expressly to benefit me, like they didn't feel right. There was something not right about this whole thing. So I, that's how I ended up in Egypt is, I just kind of, my parents are super tolerant and like, were always really supportive. And like, you know, if I came home and told my dad, like, I'm an English lit major. And he was like, as long as you're the best English lit major, you've done the best thing you can do for yourself. And like, so I like, and I would just keep going and going. So I would call home and say, I'm moving to Egypt. Like, Egypt, that sounds like an amazing experience. I think you're going to transform in big ways. I'm like, okay. So I go to Egypt. Wow. And I, you know, was in like a master's program over there. I was in classes with Egyptians. Most of the people that were responsible for the 2011 Egyptian uprising, the Tahrir Square, like I did my master's degrees with them. I've been in their weddings. Wow. Like we know each other. The Muslim Brotherhood who briefly came to power, the president, Mohamed Morsi, I've interviewed him dozens of times.
Like,
So, I mean, it was like, you know, how do I kind of like, and the thing that kind of became inescapable, right, was like, I'm living in this mega city of Cairo, Egypt. 20 years ago, they didn't know how many people lived there. They said it was somewhere between 16 and 20 million. Like it's an unbelievable place to live. And I completely adapted to the place and I learned it and I learned. And the thing that became unmistakable to me was like, wait a second. Like all the stories I got told as a kid about my country and like how we operate in the world. And like, there's a lot of really suspicious behavior. And, you know, I was in Cairo when 9/11 happened. A bunch of my friends went off to Iraq and became very famous and somewhat disturbed journalists because of what they saw. You know, I did my PhD research in Damascus, Syria, and in all over Egypt. I got tear gas 4 or 5 times in Egypt with American tear gas that gets produced in Western Pennsylvania, which is where I grew up. Like wow. The tear gas canister had a telephone number with an area code 724. And like when you're standing in like a small village town like Damanhur in Egypt, getting tear gas by tear gas being produced by the place that you grew up in, it's a pretty politicizing sort of way to think about the world.
Were you tear gassed? What was it like to be a white guy at that time?
So this is completely fascinating. So this is 2005, November of 2005. The Egyptian parliamentary elections are going on. And I am in this village of Damanhur, Egypt, which is about 60 kilometers south of Alexandria. So it's in that like fan of the Nile Delta. And the reason I was there is because there was a Muslim Brotherhood candidate named Gamal Heshmet. And he had gotten... he'd had his election stolen from him. And so in 2005, like the community was like really ready to kind of protect Gamal Heshmet. So I kept going to Damanhur and like staying, talking to Gamal Heshmet, walking around the neighborhood with him. And like what I could tell from this guy is even though he was in the Muslim Brotherhood, he was like a university professor. He was like a leader in his community. He was an excellent neighbor. He was like, you know, like, if he saw kids on the street, he was handing them like little sweets out of his pocket. Right. I mean, just like this is who this guy was. And the government hated this guy. So I was with Gamal Heshmet in the entourage all day. And it was about 6 o'clock at night. And they wanted to go to this voting station, which was a school, like a primary school that the security forces and the central security forces, the riot police were guarding. They weren't letting any voters in. Right. So we're standing in this like square and the Brotherhood people start throwing rocks at the security and like saying, let us in, let us in. And so the security starts firing back tear gas. So the tear gas lands and it starts to go off. And all I remember is like these women, old women coming out of their balconies, like in the apartment blocks around, and they had taken their hijabs and wrapped them around their noses and faces. And they started dumping like baskets of onions over the sort of balconies. And I'm like watching all this stuff, and like some kid, he was probably more like 12, but in my mind's eye, he's 10, but I have a 10-year-old, so I don't think he was that young, but I would say 12, 13. This 12-year-old, 13 Egyptian kid goes over, grabs this onion, cracks it against the concrete curb, right? And jams this onion into my face. And all of a sudden, every sort of liquid pore in my body drained and the tear gas was gone. And the only thing I could think of in that moment was, he's fucking done that before.
Yeah.
Like the entire community sprung into action and knew what to do.
And did it. Children.
And so, you know, and like, you know, and then, you know, there were other parts of like living in Cairo. Like it was an authoritarian state run by a dictator that was in power for 30 years, trying to put his son into power. Like it was corrupt. The police were corrupt. But like, I don't think I've ever lived in a society that is more democratically connected to one another through human interaction.
Transcending the rest of that.
Everybody knows you in your apartment block. You know everybody. You need salt or sugar. You knock on a neighbor's door. You're in the street, random person, opportunity for a conversation. Whether you want it or not, they're going to talk to you. And it's not because you're sort of an American, like it's anybody.
Right. Haven't we democratized ourselves into the opposite now?
Exactly.
Where you're not, you're going to wait. Wait, I'm going to help you, but wait a minute. Which side of this are you on?
Yeah.
Egyptians
just understood like instinctively, like the state is not here to help us. It's not here to educate us. It's not here to feed us. It's not here to give us healthcare. We do that. So like, if, you know, they noticed the bridge was collapsing, like it was like a communal affair. People are coming out with duct tape and building scaffoldings and because they don't want anybody to get hurt.
Right.
And it's just like.
So you understand the sentiment of why the United States of America was created and we're still young, but. I don't know what the rest of my sentence or question is. Like, what?
Well, I, you know, for me, right, it's a choice. We can choose to live differently. We can choose to kind of interact with the structures that organize our lives differently. And you know, the reason why me becoming an academic was kind of such a difficult experience emotionally and sort of spiritually was because like you sit in a room by yourself and you have to like pop out occasionally with like some sort of product that like proves that you're worthy. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty good at that. I got very good at that game. And you know, the problem was when I got to the ultimate stage of my career, like I felt empty. Proud that I had produced this thing, but empty. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my relationships with my students were strained. My relationships with my colleagues were estranged. You know, things were not good in my house. Like, I mean, and so all of this stuff was me not dealing with that sort of complex PTSD. And 2019 was basically just one big crash. Mm. And in January, like after I had read All About Love by Bell Hooks and I had been working, like, you know, I was trying all kinds of stuff. Like I tried going to a church and they had like, you know, meditative readings and that was awesome. And the second that there was a problem in Israel and Palestine, and I said, can I please tell these people what is going on in Israel and Palestine since we talk about these places every Sunday? And they said, no. I was like, I'm out. This is not the right place. This is not where this is going to happen. It's too much of a contradiction for me to be here. And so, you know, I just think that to me, this is the stuff that matters. And I think we can control these spaces. And so being an academic, right, I was unraveling this stuff in January of 2020. And like my second book arrived on my doorstep on March 11th. 2020. And I first saw it and I said, oh, what did I order from Amazon? My wife is going to kill me. And I kind of cracked the book open and I saw it was my book. And I thought, oh, cool. I shut it and I threw it off to the side. So I was like, we'll open that tonight. And we were literally sitting on the couch with the book. I'm holding it. And like, you know, they go on and they cancel the NBA season. Right. It comes on the TV.
Here it comes.
And then, so then what I did, because I was on research leave, is I just sort of like did like some sort of Joker laugh and shut my computer and was like, I'm not going to think about that for like 6 months. And lockdown for me was a time period of being outside with my kids and reading whatever I wanted to read. And just kind of practicing my home yoga, cooking. I did so much cooking. I mean,
did you have a sourdough starter like the rest of America?
I did, but I had no patience for that. So, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it was, I mean, so that and that then, and so yoga, meditation, sort of intermittent fasting that I practice. I like cold and hot. Heat and cold therapy or exposure. Mm-hmm. You know, these are all kind of my practice. Journaling obviously is a big practice of mine.
How long have you been journaling? What's your journaling practice like?
My whole life. My whole life I've been journaling. Like I can go find journals in my parents' house from like 25 years ago from when I'm traveling places and writing down things.
And do you, like that? Does that do anything for the dealing with the PTSD?
So, I mean, I think it does. And I think that the process that I've been on since January of 2020 is really one about embodiment, right? Like I told Joyce this story once, like I listened to Yoga with Adrian tell me for 5 months, like feel your feet in the ground. And like one day I felt my feet and I could not, I mean, I used to tell Dawn Rivers at Daybreak Yoga that I didn't take a conscious breath until I was 43.
Hmm.
Right. I mean, and like, you know, I have like a pretty nice marathoning career in my 30s. And I mean, you know, I have all these, but like none of it was really contemplative, or all of it was sort of contemplative. I just didn't really understand it. The reason I like to write is because I can get into a zone like all time, just, and I'm existing in some other space.
Yeah. You're in the flow state.
I'm in the flow state. Right. And so really this whole project has been about becoming more embodied, understanding myself more, understanding that I'm changed, like deep observation of the breath, but like tying all these parts together, integrating them all together. And then, you know, I mean, I have the best job in the world. I get to deal with 18 to 22 year olds.
Temporarily.
And, well, I mean, absolutely. Right. And, but the thing about it is right. Like, I think that we've forgotten how difficult it is to be 18 or 22. And especially, you know, they live on these devices all the time. And like literally their college experiences, they come into the room and you tell them like, hey, you guys can relax. I'm a nice guy. And they just do not relax. I've surveyed my students, like 60% of them have anxiety on the first day of class.
Yeah, I was just going to say being able to be a student among them, it was a creative writing program. So we were all, you know, there was maybe 12 to 15 students together. They were, you know, mostly younger. There was the occasional adult with me, but I remember some of these kids saying, it wasn't everybody's major necessarily. They were some in these classes and I don't know. I don't have anything to write about. I don't have anything to write about. And we had some great professors at Baldwin Wallace, a younger than me guy, probably about your age, Michael Garriga. He was just great at just conversing. And so through conversing, come to find out some of these kids had already lost their parents or a sibling or had a major illness or abuse or abandonment. And there I was in my 40s. I still had both my parents who were still married and just living my bologna and mayo on white bread life. And I'm like, you guys think you have nothing to write about? They were all, not all, but most suffering from anxiety, depression, you know,
oh yeah,
sexuality issues, gender issues, a lot wrong.
But
in their,
they didn't
in their
recognize it because it was such a part of them, right?
They recognize all the things wrong and that they.
Well, and the system is pointing one thing after another about how these are all deficiencies in your core being and, you know, need to be altered, changed, beautified, slimmed down. Mm-hmm. I mean, right. So this is the context they're growing up in. Then like they go from one class to another where you have somebody telling like, if you don't understand that, like, you know, the English parliament works in this way, like, forget it. You can just forget life. You're not going to get paid. You're going to live as a bum, like, which I always tell them, like, is not true. But like, that's happening to them 5 classes a week. Right.
Yeah.
And then the last thing is like, when they call home, right, at the end of the day, it's what'd you do today? What did you produce? Are you wasting our money? Mm-hmm. What's going to, you know? And so like, they don't have any advocates or allies, and they basically have to emerge in adulthood on their own. And so one thing I do is I try to be an adult that cares for them, that supports them, and also like an adult that they feel comfortable and safe emerging around. Right. And this has required drastic changes in my pedagogy or teaching approach. So like Paulo Freire, the pedagogy of the oppressed, where he basically says, if you want this to work right, it has to be in a sort of non-hierarchical, decentralized way of like a learning community, meaning that the student is learning as well as the teacher's learning. So you have like a tie there. And then, you know, to bring it back to sort of like Black feminism, they write the policies of my classrooms. It's a very simple sort of statement. Like, if we are free, everybody is free. Right? And so you might have heard of trickle-down economics, which is like the ideology that we were raised on, that like eventually the money is going to trickle down. We like to call this in my classroom bottom-up democracy. Because if the most marginalized, the most discriminated against, the most invisible person is seen, then everybody's seen and taken care of. And we don't have to sit around, okay, well, you like these people more than these people. Like, real equality, like, I really haven't found a problem that equality doesn't solve. And you know, the other thing that what you're describing, Mary Beth, is that's my life. Like, I have my political positions because I've got to deal with trans students that I had as a boy and then became a woman and then got kicked out of his house and then needed mental health counseling at Kent State University, which they wouldn't provide to her for like 6 or 8 weeks. They told her, go to the LGBTQ thing at Cleveland Clinic, but she doesn't have a car. Like, how's she going to get there? Like, I mean, and it's just like, it's absurd. And so what I did is I made a phone call over to the counseling thing. And I said, hi, this is Professor Stacker. I need to talk to who's in charge. I have a student that I need you to see. And they were in there at 12:30. Mm-hmm. Right. And so like, exactly. Right. And so once I figured out like, oh, like people listen to me in that capacity or whatever, you know, and so I can't really have exclusionary politics and do what I do, because what do I do for the Black Palestinian student in my class, right? Or what do I do for, you know, a Jewish student in my class or a poor student in my class, right? And so what I do is I construct these sort of classrooms, right, where they become really much about expression and people share amazingly traumatic things that happen to them with me. And I usually respond like, one, please go talk to a professional about this. I will help you set that up, which they never want to do.
Right.
And then secondly, they just kind of say something like to me, like, look, I'm not going to hurt myself or anything. I just wanted somebody to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, I become like their witness.
Mm.
Right. And then, you know, we build classroom community. And so The reason why I ended up in YTT, right, is like I have this theory that I can teach my college classrooms like a yoga class. I mean, they're essentially the same thing in my mind. I start my classes with a 2 to 3 minute meditation. So we get grounded in, right? And then we do, 4 or 5 minutes of movement, just sort of chair yoga, right? Just to kind of get into our seats. And then we do 5 minutes of like community time. Does anybody have anything of any importance that they want to discuss? Did you win some award? Did your girlfriend break up with you? Like, what do you need to get out, right? And then we have that moment. And then we move into the topic of the day. I give all my students reading, podcast, and documentary sort of options. They don't have to do all three. I'd like for them to do one of the three. So if you learn visually, watch the documentary. If you got a part-time job, listen to the podcast. And if you're a reader, which there are not many of us left, but if you're a reader, then there you go, right? And students appreciate the options, and then they appreciate the journals because they can express to me what goes on. And I don't really grade their journals. So I don't go, oh, this is an A journal and that's a B journal. Yes. I just give them credit for it, sort of like what we do at YTT. The thing I do is I provide them like meaningful feedback. So they send me like a Google document with their thoughts, and I in the Google document return shots back like, wow, if you like this, listen to that podcast. If you like this, read that book, right? And so I have really meaningful sort of exchanges with my students. So then after we do the 50 minutes, right, then we sort of like decompress the last 10 minutes. And then we have a minute of gratitude, and then we in class.
Yeah. So you probably have a more effective 30 minute curriculum time than many using 50 minutes for it.
Minimum relevant words.
MRW.
Well, and the other thing is like, if you do have students that have options, like, okay, I won't read, but I'll watch a documentary, or I'll listen, like more people come to class having done something. And so they can do more of the collective sort of lifting of the class. And then I can go into like complete spontaneous mode. I was sort of joking, every time I get a new YTT that becomes and is like, they stick to the script, right? And then I notice I do the same thing too. And then the longer you do it, you get a little bit more creative and you know, there's a little more spontaneity. And that just becomes from a mastery of sort of repetition, right? Right. You know instinctively when the moment to change courses, you know instinctively how to read the room. Having this ability kind of in my mid-career academia as a teacher to go through YTT and basically sort of been like rethinking how to teach, rethinking how to like get somebody into an experience, rethinking how to stay out of the way, right? Rethinking what a trauma-informed inclusive room looks like, right? I do it in my work and I do it in my yoga practice. And so there's just like deep synergy. And, you know, I am a regular at the 9:30 Monday through Friday. And the reason that is because my wife and I split how we do it. I handle the morning, she handles the afternoons. So I don't actually have to be down at Kent until about noon. And then I'll stay till, you know, six or so. And then she goes in early. And so I get the kids off to the bus. And once they're off the bus, what I do is I do yoga. And that's like the start of my day. It's that transition. And that sets up the rest of the day. It sets up my teaching. It sets up my compassion. I'm just more balanced that way. And then so, you know, I come home from work and I've had nothing but amazing, mm-hmm. thoughtful, meaningful exchanges all day with these like 18 to 22 year olds who they don't adore me because of who I am. They adore me because of how I am with them. Right.
And then how you make them feel.
Right. And then I come home and like, how was your day? Like, amazing. Like, mm-hmm. this happened and this happened. Right. And so there's less stress on those relationships.
What does your wife do, Josh?
My wife works for the legal department at the Cleveland Clinic. She like coordinates all that stuff.
Okay, so she's not an academic. No. How is it having a partner and not knowing anything about her? How is it having a partner when you're going through such an arguably unusual journey or method of things? We all don't, you know, walk the same gate down these paths. How's that?
Oh, it's a great question. I mean, so my wife's name is Yasna, and she moved to the United States in 1999. She had lived in Germany for 5 years before that. And she had grown up in Bosnia in the former Yugoslavia. Mm. And they were forcibly moved from their home, from they lost their house, their dog. Their mom left with like a bag of documents and Yasna was 16. And you know, they went to Germany and she learned German, and then they moved to here and she had to learn English. They lived in Houston for a year. Then they lived in Cleveland because there was a lot of former Yugos on up in the East Side where they right. were, where my mother-in-law and father-in-law still live. You know, Yasna had to go to community college for a couple of years before she could transfer into CSU and get out of CSU debt free. Like she very, very sort of, I mean, immigrant about mm-hmm. this place. She has a big family, these sorts of things. And so, you know, I think that my career as an academic, right, it was driven by my complex PTSD to like keep performing, right? And I mean, you know, I've adored Yasna since the moment I met her. I had a hard time managing sort of that complex PTSD, that ability to perform, the sort of ego driven things. Like, you know, I can remember one time I was pacing the Akron Marathon. It happens on a Saturday in September. And this outfit called and said, "Can you come to Helsinki and give a talk?" And I was like, "Yes." And she was like, "What?" And I said, "I've never been to Helsinki, like whatever." And like, I flew to Helsinki on like a Tuesday, landed on a Wednesday, went for a 12-mile run in the rain, went to bed, got up, ran another 12 miles, went to bed, came back, got showered, went, gave the lecture, had the lunch, and then was taken to the airport. And I landed at like 11 o'clock on Friday night. And at 6 a.m, I was like leading the 3:35 pace group. And like, this was my life like that. I mean, I had a friend one time invite me to Austin, Texas to participate in the workshop on Friday and Saturday. And the Austin Marathon was on Sunday. So I just stayed the extra night, ran the Austin Marathon. I ran the first part of it in like 3:40 pace. And the last 6 miles, I was like, maybe like 6:45 pace, because I was wow. working on fast turnover late in a race when your legs are tired. And then, you know, went and had Mexican, got on a plane, got back and taught at 9:30 the next morning.
Yeah, I mean, you're all these wonderful qualities that you've arrived at now, especially as a teacher and professor. I mean, you have to be difficult to live with, or have had to have been difficult to live with in the past. Well, I mean, you know, 100%. This is a lot. Like, you're driven by something that she may understand because she's had some stuff. But a person like myself would be like, "Look, I don't know what's going on in there, but I just don't know if I can hang on to the caboose while you fly around."
So Yasna, like, she truly is my soulmate in respect that she is like the utter opposite of me. And because of her experiences and because of my experiences, like, you know, the kids will come over and say, like, "Can we get a new Nintendo?" And I'm like, "Sure, why not?" And she comes out and says, "We have a Nintendo. Why would we need a second one? Like, what is wrong with you people? Why do all you want to do is consume? Like, why don't we just go to mom's house and have dinner? Right. And so, you know, yeah, I mean, and
again,
I think that
you're Yang.
Yeah, exactly. And like, so, you know, I mean, she's just like a steady rock and, you know, I need her. And like, look, I'd lived in the Middle East. I know lots of displaced populations. Like I know tons of Palestinians. Right. And so I knew what a refugee experience looked like abstractly and through a lived experience of somebody else. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of trauma and hurt there too, but that's okay. I mean, yeah. I think we're here to kind of pull out this sort of toxic stuff and sort of find a better way to live.
And how wonderful to have found that partner, because you're not for everyone.
Absolutely not. No.
I mean, none of us are. So it's on top of everything else.
There tends to be a little bit of level of intensity that, mm-hmm. yeah. But I mean, look, all of this stuff came into the service. Like, so one of the things I started teaching, like after the pandemic, right, was like, why do we live this way? Like, what is about it that we live this way? And so we started looking at like some Karl Marx stuff just to see what his analysis was. And like, ultimately what the students and I came down upon was the idea that like economic structures that are run for profit, they can't be human. They just can't. There's no human aspect to it. And so, you know, we are forced in this country to engage with our economic structures so that we can make a living. And like, we can debate about whether we have enough or too little healthcare or too much or too little education. I mean, or less of a defense budget, maybe, you know, we can talk about all of these different qualities. But I think ultimately, right, that what the students understood and what they taught me is like, you don't have to be the economic structure. Like, it's a machine that you sort of zap into, get what you need, and then pull out of. You don't like, and where I think most of our generation came from is like the funnel, like you are what you do, right? And then
you lose your identity essentially in this funnel.
Absolutely, 100%, right? And I mean, it's hard. And so it's like, how do we maintain our humanity when effectively we're in these economic structures that are deeply violent and also dehumanizing, right?
And I think that like, there's so many things that these ideas that you've mentioned that tie together, right? That so you at some point realized, I might have complex PTSD. You're seeing that in your kids that you teach. They don't realize they have complex PTSD. And then they think they have nothing to write about because nobody is telling them that they're interesting or valuable, or everything they're hearing from the outside world or their inside world is that they're not good enough because they're not following the economic structure. And so people end up taking courses in life or following paths to follow money and success, but deny their true being. And then no wonder why we're all angry.
Exactly.
But then also the realization that you do have to tap into that economic structure,
right,
for healthcare, for clean water, for safe roads. So that's the muddle that we are in, is how to balance that. Like, we can't pretend like, I don't want to go live on a dirt road with no indoor plumbing and, you know, not tap into the economic structure. So we're that's what I mean. Keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. So you lived in a different country for 9 years. I visited Nepal for 2 weeks on a mission trip, and they don't have indoor plumbing everywhere, and there isn't electricity everywhere. And I came back and we worked with kids who were sold into slavery and rescued from slavery and things like that. And I came back to the United States, like really understanding or thinking how privileged we are. But then I look back at the things that weren't terrible over there. And like you said,
boy,
everybody knows each other. Like there's community, like true community, because you don't have all of this other stuff. You know, it's not, it's about survival to a degree, but it's also about, I felt like after that trip, I was like, I prefer that type of trip over like a vacation because I felt that I lived in the culture. You can go sit at a pool and drink margaritas anywhere the sun shines. But if you don't ever leave that property and get into the culture, you're not really having the experience of being in a different place.
So it really reminds me of this old like Islamic saying that I used to hear when I lived in Egypt a lot, something like travel is a moral hazard and it's to be undertaken like with incredible carefulness. Like it's a sacred journey. You only do it really if you need to know something, right? It's sort of the opposite of leisure travel, right? Or how leisure travel gets practiced today, which again, like if we pull the thread, gets very back to sort of money, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the places that I love how you frame that, Joyce. And one of the places that we just got back from vacation was the Dominican Republic. So I have a very active 9-year-old who is a pretty decent athlete, and he's on a 9U baseball team. They went down to the Dominican and they played all these Dominican kids. And it was great because
so let's just clarify. Josh took his 9-year-old to the Dominican Republic to play baseball.
It's a position of extreme privilege. Yes. But like, you know, the thing about it is like, we got to be with the families that we spent the last year with. And we spend so much time together with baseball that it does sort of have this sort of family vibe. And because you spend so much time together, right, you can't talk about the weather and not religion forever, right? Right. Eventually, right. People start to show their cards.
The real relationships you're
and,
having.
And then you're starting to navigate these relationships and like, holy shit, it feels like community, which is why I think a lot of parents are okay paying, you know, a couple thousand dollars to play sports because it sort of buys them sort of access to other humans that they then there have to make a campfire with. Yeah. But the other thing I was going to say about like our privileges and these sorts of things, I heard a couple people on this trip say something like, man, I am so glad I'm American. And like, we weren't born here. Right. Because there was pretty bad poverty. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, unfortunately, my poverty meter, I've been to India, I've been to China, I've lived in Egypt. Like the Dominican is incredibly poor, but it's not anything like those places. And that's not to minimize what's there, but I think more likely to like reframe how we think about like, man, I'm so glad that we are like, maybe we live this way because they live that way. Like they're structured into a certain economic thing that basically says, okay, the Dominican Republic, what can we get here? Bananas? Okay, what else can we get here? Baseball players. Anything else? Like, nope, that's it. Right? And so that's how right, exactly. And so, you know, I think that in a way, right, because of the immense privileges that we have, right? Other people are sort of have to live in sort of extreme poverty for that to happen. I mean, like if you think about like traveling in planes, right? Only 6% of the world's population gets on a plane.
And we do it without even thinking.
Oh, we won't even show up on time, right? Like we show up like, okay, is it ready to go? Like,
and complain about how we have to
search me, right? I mean, yeah. So, I mean,
somebody had said to me after my trip to Nepal, like, well, why wouldn't you just leave if you live there? I'm like, well, the dollar exchange is 75-1. So families traditionally or typically make 200 to 300 rupees a month. And that is nothing.
I mean, the valiant struggle of immigrants that made it here and are working here is unbelievable. On such a smaller scale, I just want to tell a story that when we were kids, my dad, just because you brought baseball into it, my dad was a huge baseball fan. And we did go on vacation every year, but we didn't really have the means to go anywhere, you know, fancy. But along those lines of travel, opening a Pandora's box, my dad coming home from Cleveland Indians games would drive us through poverty-stricken neighborhoods on purpose. And we were teenage girls and we would roll our eyes and be like, seriously, Dad. And he said, do you think these people don't love their children? Do you think these people aren't working hard for their children? And those are the kind of things that, so that was just a little tiny bit of travel off the mean suburban streets, you know, of Middleburg Heights and to inner city Cleveland. But exposing ourselves and our children to that Pandora's box and making you think, making you feel sick or guilty, or at least examine what's going on, is a Pandora's box, because you can't unknow what you know. And then that, and just like your yoga journey and your other journey that I was asking about your wife, this makes it difficult to have some relationships in our lives. It makes us roll our eyes at each other. You know, people start rolling their eyes at you at what you're saying. And then you too are like rolling your eyes at what, you know, it's like what you just said about glad we were born in America. My granddaughter, who's 9, we stopped on our way taking her home to North Carolina at some kind of rundown farmer's market, just nice, normal people, farmers and stuff. And she said something like, oh, this is kind of gross. I'm glad we're not poor. Mm-hmm. And I became my dad and I was driving. So I said to my husband, handed him the phone, and I said, look up humility. And we need to talk about the definition of this. And it was fine. She's a sweet girl. It was fine. But it's like,
she's 9. Like, yeah, but it's an interesting reflection of society that society's had on her.
Exactly. Right. I mean, she's just saying what she's learned. Right. And I think this is the thing, like having really deep, meaningful relationship with people that have utterly different experiences than yourself, like they're hard, right? Because it's not like they're not you, like, but it's also like where we learn a lot. And I think that, like, you know, like I said, being a member of like Daybreak Yoga for 18 months, like it was an unbelievable sort of experience, right? And it was so meaningful. And like all the different types of people that I work with, whether they're, you know, Asian or you know, whether they're Indian or whatever, it these people make such a deep impact on my life that like I almost feel like I'm suffocating living like we live, which is basically racially sort of segregated.
And because of your living in other places and what you'd already been through, you at that yoga studio in Bedford stuck with it. How many people would have been a white male, gone in there one time and been like, nope?
Well, you know, I had read a bunch of this Black feminism. Like I knew what they were talking about. I knew what the healing culture was. And so, you know, I knew what some of the triggers were, right? And so I could allow them just to be themselves, and then I could be myself, and then you have organic relationship making,
right? And be unselfconscious as yourself, which is what most of us would struggle with in that situation.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like Egypt beat that out of me, right? Like,
right, exactly.
The number of rooms that I was the only white guy in, and I mean, it was good too, right? Because I would hear different points of view, and like, you know, it's really difficult to have a really good friend who looks you in the eye that you've like studied and got master's degrees from, And he says, like, you know, the reason why the security comes to my house is because, you know, your government allows it to happen. Man, that's rough, man. Like, you know, and there's no Obama, Biden, Trump out of it. Like, all of them, right, are in on it.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, and so again, it's this like question that we're faced with. These are our political structures. These are our economic structures. How do we navigate those with skill? How do we extract from those experiences what we need, not what we want, right? And then how do we get out of those structures and into sort of campfire settings or mm-hmm. places where we sing together or places where we practice yoga together, mm-hmm. right? I mean, and I think that's why people clap at the end of Power, because like collectively we've done something that we're applauding all mm-hmm. of us for, right? It's just like, it's like the one time in the studio where everybody sort of is like a recognized collective.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. A little fist pump at the end, like, whew.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, we just did a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. We just, and that's, I'm really glad you said that. Cause it's, I think it's just become so normal that it's just there, but we do kind of talk about this sometimes. Like why are they clapping? Cause the class, as we talk about in teacher training, the class isn't about me. I hope you're clapping for yourself.
Right. That's what it's like. I don't want you to be clapping. Like I just finished an aria and you're clapping for me. We have to struggle with that. We've known a teacher before who, when everyone's eyes were closed in Shavasana, surrounded herself with candles so that when they came back at the end, she was like a glow in the middle. And like, that's the last thing we want to feel like we're doing.
Yeah.
See, I take it as a collective cheer, you know, and you know, cool. Egyptians and Dominicans, when we land in the Dominican Republic, all the Dominicans on the plane clapped, and Egyptians have been clapping when the plane landed for as long as I've been going to Egypt. And I always think it's pretty amazing. Like there's this expectation that like, you may not come back down on the ground.
We might not make it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And when you get on the ground, it's like, okay, like, thank you for getting us here safely. We're all getting there safely. Right. And like when we landed in Newark from the Dominican, silent plane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, where's my bag?
Yeah, exactly. Can we get this? Can this be any faster? Because I'm a slightly bored to get off this plane.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then like, so it's just, I think to me, like, I find that people in the developing world, people in the sort of global South, like Black women in America, they're excellent teachers because the conditions that they're under are much more incredibly difficult than I face. And like the responses to the conditions that they face of like utter invisibility, dehumanization, all the rest of stuff, it has to manifest. The opposition has to manifest itself in life. In abundance. And like, that's the lesson. Like, that's how we learn to live. That's how we learn to like hold one another in sort of like a yoga space.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like, it all goes back to that Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Like all of our needs are really met. All those lower things are met. We can take for granted. So we can worry about these other things. Other people have to find joy and at the same time, try and eat.
Exactly.
Not die or be killed or whatever. And at the same time, we have to defend our American ideals of freedom, prosperity, safety. Like I said, clean water, clean roads. So this is, it's a lot to try and figure out and not be an a-hole in one direction or the other, which is such an inarticulate way I'm saying this, but like, we're just being a-holes to each other about every issue. If you don't agree with me, you're clearly fucking nuts and get off my feed.
Right. And this is not how we're going to have any resolution at all. And I was trying to do something on like overcoming trauma through yoga for my book report, but I decided to read the Gita. And I am so glad that I did that because like, particularly the parts where they're like, inaction is not a decision. Like you can't just be inactive, right? And you know, the famous sort of labor historian, Howard Zinn, always said, you can't be neutral on a moving train, right? And to me, right? I think we can all, and like when people look at how I handle my classrooms at Kent or how, like, of course you like, they like you. You don't really judge them. Like, no, because I don't want to judge them. Like, I want to help them like emerge and feel safe. Like they have valid opinions and experiences and everything else because they do.
Well, like and yesterday, Well, yesterday in training, we talked a moment about how you don't know as a yoga teacher if a student has really heard what you said, because it might not really land until the next class or the next class or the next year or off the mat or in the grocery store. And Josh, you're nodding your head because you said, yeah, kids will come back later after class, after the semester, after they graduate and say, you were onto something. I really learned something here.
When Josh finally connected with grounding at yoga class. It wasn't the first time. It wasn't the first 10 times.
Right. The first time you took a conscious breath, you were 43. You know, like who taught that? Everybody did before you took that breath.
Yeah. And I mean, this is why, like, you know, I know that there's some trepidation around like, well, I go to a class and somebody does something and I like it and I borrow it and I put it in. Like, I don't see that as like plagiaristic or because like one, I couldn't represent the way that that person did the thing that I'm borrowing at this point. If I wanted to, I couldn't do it the exact same way they did. So I can only do it like I can do it, which means that it has to go through some sort of transformative process inside my body before it comes out. And in the process of it coming out, it's now mine, right? Or it's now public knowledge.
Right.
Right? Well, and let's face it, we aren't inventing anything here.
No.
Yeah. No. Thousands of years old. The other thing I wanted to say relative for how you run your classroom or treat kids there is that you have the knowledge of knowing that everywhere else they're being judged and pushed and put in boxes. So what would the world be like if everyone was like you? Who knows? But you don't have to worry about that because 99% of the time they're not getting heard or allowed to be who they are. So, you know, you might be the only place they get seen and are seen and met for who they are.
A lot of power. And not my power, it's their power, right?
Right?
I'm recognizing their power. I tell my students two things, right? One, the first thing I always, this is like first or second class, and I say it every semester. I don't care what you're going to do with your life in terms of a profession. That's something your parents think about. I care about how you're going to be in this world. And that seems to land really well with them. And the second thing I tell them is that there's no such thing as teachers and students, like as definitive things. It's a flow state. And so the difference is, if you have a little bit more experience than the other people around you, you get to, you're talking and the student should know when to be quiet. And if the student starts to sort of teach, then it's up to the teacher to know, oh, they're teaching now. I have to go into sort of student mode. And so
watching this Zoom call, right? I see three faces, me, you, and Joyce. And whichever of us is talking is the one that's highlighted and lit up in this square, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know what your view looks like, but so that's what it's like. Then when your student starts to talk, your square unlights and it's them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we're all the student and the teacher.
Are you saying that you want a square to light up around you?
You light up my life. They're just a little younger, so I don't know if you remember that Debbie Boone classic.
I do. I do. I catch most of your references, but I sometimes think, oh, there's going to be people who have no idea who that is.
Oh, right. I forget what I said yesterday, and it was, oh, I know. I do know. I was trying to talk about grounding, rooting, but in a seat, in an easy seat. And I said, does anybody remember the ashtrays of the 1970s where it was like a beanbag bottom that was heavy?
I do.
Don't cover your face. Right. Because that's the feeling I want to impart, like, let your butt be that heavy. You're grounded. And then, yeah, it just fell apart. And there's a couple of people that are old and they look at me like, what are you doing? Really?
I remember those.
Somebody in teacher training, it might've been yesterday, said, because we were talking about like stuff that comes out of your mouth. And somebody said that you say, Mary Beth, I've never heard you say this, but like, you'll say something funny that kind of surprises you. And then you're like, what other shit have I said? Like, what else is coming out of my mouth? But I've done the thing where I'm like, I'm like the cruise director. I'm like Julie McCoy. And then I'm like, oh shit. Yeah. Anybody know who Julie McCoy is? And it's like a few people raise their hand. And then I'm like, forget it. Just forget it.
I mean, I've quit doing it altogether because like their references are like the last 6 months. Right.
Right. Right.
This is like when Bill Clinton, they're like, who is Bill
who?
Clinton?
All we know about is a blue dress and a cigar. We don't need to know the guy's name. Hey, I noticed we've thrown around YTT a lot. So for anybody who was confused and you didn't figure it out, that just means yoga teacher training.
Yeah. Josh is in our 200-hour yoga teacher training program.
Not to be confused with PYT. The young thing.
Michael Jackson reference.
PYT. You know, there was a, where did I just see some sort of Michael Jackson tribute or something? And I thought, I wonder how that's going. Like, are we supposed to avoid Michael Jackson music because of?
There's actually a really good podcast about that.
Oh, really?
Like, do the tell. Rise and fall of Michael Jackson, or like why, how did they frame it? Like, why some people just kind of still worship him and overlook everything else.
Right. Which we do with art. I mean, Roman Polanski, anyone? Like, there's a lot that we overlook for
Sean
art.
Watson.
And yeah. And like, you don't want the art to disappear. You don't want the history to disappear. So that too is a walk, like without paying the person continually, giving them more accolades, but you also can't like whitewash and make disappear things.
I think it's called Think Twice.
So what are you done with these? Okay. Thanks.
Hi guys. Or guys.
What's up, Eli? So, I was 7 when Thriller came out. I had a glove. I had the jacket. Mm-hmm. I had the penny loafers, the white socks. Mm-hmm. Michael Jackson.
If you can find a picture of that, we'd love to share it with the podcast, Josh.
We'd have to talk to my mother.
From Egypt. We need that picture.
Yeah. Well, and I think that like
marathon,
I mean,
running picture,
there is some pain connected to that because it does sort of change the experience. But the way that I kind of think about it is like, I don't really go around promoting Michael Jackson. If my kids came up to me and said like, I'd like to be Michael Jackson for Halloween, we might have a different conversation about why that we might want to do that. However,
unless you're prepared to talk about it.
I mean, Michael Jackson is a fallible human being like all of us. His things are just different than most of ours. And, you know, I mean, it's pretty clear to me that he was utterly tortured as a child, utterly sexualized as a child, utterly controlled. You know, I mean, in a lot of ways, right? I mean, he was sick.
And this was everything that we just talked about, right? Like following money.
The economic
society.
Structures.
Yeah.
When you become the economic structures, you become a monster because you have no regulating or restraining capability. And like, what's the difference between $150,000 and $200,000 house or $400,000 house? Like, more is bigger, more is better. Like, and it's just, it's the reason why we can go to the Dominican on what they pay college professors and sort of administrators is because we just don't buy a lot of stuff. Right. We're really intentional with how we spend our money. And again, that's Yasna's experience of like having to walk out of her house with her papers and no money.
Mm-hmm.
And then having to rely on Catholic charities and having to rely on the goodness of other people. And, you know, allowing it, like learning how to be sort of okay with being vulnerable, receiving help and these sorts of things. But then also like when your situation changes, right? Like being mindful that there's people out there and need your help and right. And I mean, at the end of the day, like, you know, we don't really need all that much.
No, we really don't. And that's why it's for us Americans, it's become like a cool experience to downsize or to get rid of stuff. Like, what a luxury is that? I think I'll get rid of all my stuff.
And then the burdens that get left away, right? But all those things and all that stuff that we're throwing away at one time, we desperately wanted, like, which, yeah, you know, just kind of tracks that sort of like the gunas or whatever, like the three different energies.
Funny little meme where I get all my wisdom, I always say, from Facebook memes, but it's about, in my purse, there's 1,000 little receipts that if I bind them together, forms a book about why I'm broke.
Well, I think it's better just to kind of, you know, live a little bit more austere. Like, what do
but we, Mary Beth know? Needs another journal.
I just have a lot of notebooks. But didn't COVID help with that, though, for some of us anyway?
Yeah.
If not just with possessions and shopping, but living back, like you said, the campfire. I mean, that's when we actually built a fire pit. And Jeff calls it COVID, Mary, because I was like actually baking things. And I don't bake, I cook, but I was making, there was like creme brulee. And he was like, what happened to COVID, Mary?
I, for the first time during COVID, during quarantine, realized that my home was just a place that we checked in at, but we didn't really live in.
Right.
And our situation then was, we own a small business, so we were very, very worried about the future and had no idea what was going to happen, and ended up doing a ton of teacher training, which saved us. And so we, even though we were home all day, every day, sometimes we were starting at 8 a.m. and ending at 8 p.m. So we didn't have the luxury of having the time to like do the home upgrades and all the projects that everybody else did. And I actually got jealous for the first time in my life. Like, no, I want that time to spend making this place that I'm really recognizing as my home better. And, you know, and at the same time, Ashley was pregnant and we moved her home and my dad went into the hospital and died later. It was like 2020 was just a crazy time. And I still see it in my house, because as you guys both know, we just don't have a lot of time, period. And I don't know, it's just, it changed my perspective on my home and where I live, and not, you know, I'm not just leaving to come back in to have a place to sleep, you know, something a little bit different.
You know, so, you know, we grew up in a country, right, that is based on sort of displacements, right? One, are our ancestors being displaced from Europe? Because let's face it, nobody in 1700 Germany is like, let's get on a boat to the other side of the world. I think there's going to be good living over there. It's like things are so bad that like they don't, right?
Right.
And then, and like in my case, like 10th or 11th generation, everybody's lived in sort of Pennsylvania, like 9 generations have lived within 15 miles of each other. And like, here I am at sort of at this moment of sort of economic change in America, the 80s, 90s and 2000s. And like, I'm flung over to Egypt. I'm asking questions. I'm trying to figure stuff out. And like in the process, like I'm living in Cairo, I'm living in Damascus, I'm living in St. Andrews in Scotland, where I got my PhD. I'm living in Syracuse on a 1-year gig. I'm interviewing at sort of jobs all over the country. And like the thing that like becomes clear to me is like, the reason I need to be grounded is because I have no grounding. Like I can't really go back to Western Pennsylvania because there's like way too much stuff there. And I don't really know if I can make a living there, but like I'm cut off from all those networks of generations of people. Like the reason why I was pretty anti-racist from the jump is because my parents lived in the same small town they went to high school with the black kids' parents. I went to black with their kids, and like, we knew each other. Like, we were in each other's lives in meaningful ways. And so like the idea of like racism when I got to college was hilarious because I just didn't think it was like an actual thing. And so for me, like grounding and like taking the spaces that we live in and making them sort of the home, like it requires work. You got to put a sacred space in. And the way I used to live on planes, I think I've been on two or three planes since the pandemic. And I don't care. Like, I want to be home, and this is home because this is listening. Where the most important people are.
I'm holding up this book that I bought. I was listening to a podcast. Honestly, it might have been Jesus Calling podcast, but this Carly Summers was on it, and she had been an addict and a sexual abuse survivor and everything, but she's now an interior designer. And so I got this book to be a coffee table book for my eventual place in the mountains, because they're stories of how to create, even if it's just a corner of a room for yourself or something. And this can tie back to yoga and meditation as well, to have some sacred spaces inside and outside that have nothing to do with a lot of stuff. It's just funny. You said the word sacred spaces in my Amazon box. Should I got it at Amazon?
I'm looking at Amazon right now. I'm like, oh, I need this.
Yeah. I mean, I think, cause like you think about it, right? Home is where we sleep and recuperate. Home is where we should be eating more than often than not. Home. So we're nourishing ourselves there. Home is where we spend time with the people we really, really love. And that, when all the rest of this stuff falls apart, like those are the people we want in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. And like, it's like in your face all the time. And like, we're constantly like running away from home and changing jobs or moving places. Like, you know, I mean, I like living here. I don't really know my neighbors.
Same here. How long have you been in the same spot?
10 years.
Wow.
I mean, and I know them enough by name, but I've not eaten in their house.
Do people do that anymore?
I don't think so.
Right? Well, it's funny. I live in the house I grew up in, the other side, and my parents and the neighbors lived next door to each other for 50 years before my neighbor, who's my age, once her dad passed away, they built a house and took their mom with them. But that was 10 years ago. And to your point, I know the people who moved in. I know the guy's name is Tim. I never see the wife or kids. I see him cutting the grass. We wave. He would bring in the trash can for my mom if I was out of town or something, but not like in the old days when we were just all running the hood together.
Well, and I think this is the thing we're missing. And I think this is the thing that people want. They want to have relationships. They want to have community. They want to feel validated. They want to feel like whatever their experience is, right?
And often our community, our relationship with our neighbor is about like, get off my lawn or your mailbox isn't compliant.
Exactly.
Which, it all sounds so silly when we say it out loud, but it's true. These are what these, yeah. I mean, we Joyce, there's those Facebook pages, you know, Strongsville Moms Discuss It or whatever. It can be pure entertainment.
Yeah, the Homos Association here comes after our basketball hoop on a pretty regular basis. And like, my only response really is like, are you this mean?
Is that how ridiculous?
You have two little boys.
Yeah.
And you're not supposed to have
basketball. I'm like trying to tell them, like, you understand that even though they don't pay the mortgage, they are full on residents of this street, like you are. Like, I don't look at you and say, oh, you're 70. Like, you're off the list now.
Right. Like, you can't cut your own grass. So you're not.
Right? I mean, so like, and like, I don't want to live in that world where I'm like having to kind of go to battle with people over this stupid stuff. I just try to kind of keep living in a way that makes them understand, usually publicly, like not public shaming, but like when they see it actually happen and like their eyes click, like, oh, it really doesn't matter if there's a basketball hoop here.
Is it preventing the sale of a home around you because there's a basketball hoop in your yard? What is the argument that there's a basketball hoop in the association somewhere that
yeah, be? No. That all the land is common ground, and therefore the basketball hoop is sitting on top of land that everybody owns, but like not everybody has access to. It's the argument made of people that moved here in the 1990s that really don't want things to change and have not come to terms with the fact that like, not only are things changing, but like there is like eternal turnover happening on a frequent basis, right?
Yeah. And it's worth saying publicly or out loud to them, because your life is not going to change because of this basketball hoop lady.
Right. If you've got energy to spend, this is not, you can do something else with it.
Well, and I mean, it's just like, you know, I mean, they're just kids, right? They're doing their thing. And like, I mean, they're being socialized to understand like old people are mean.
Yep.
and like, so it starts, right? And this is who I get, you know, at 18 in Kent State.
Yeah. Right? So what do we do with all of this, Josh? Like, it's hard to take this path of...
This is Josh's problem. We're just the podcast people.
Well, I think it's our... Well, it's my problem, too.
No, I'm kidding.
It's a bad choice. I mean, you can go sit in your home in the mountains and you contemplate it over your...
Whatever gets done. Now, that's away from the trappings of modern life, you know, other than the trappings of modern life. I just have to drive 40 minutes to get them.
You'll be back soon enough.
Yeah.
I mean, no, what do we do? I mean, look, I've thought about this over like 20, 25 years. I've looked at it from different social science sort of theories, Marxism, nihilism. I don't think the theories really sort of do it. Where I'm at in my current life is I sort of understand that we are facing enormously challenging obstacles that are coming in very violent ways that are going to destabilize how we live. I think that I see my practices, whether it's meditation, heat or cold exposure, yoga, these are just like my way of preparing for that sort of inevitable change. And in my body, the breath is how I embody change. So like, if I want to be change, which is really the only thing happening in the universe, then I have to be on my breath. And, you know, I think that the more one personally transforms and invests in themselves and these sorts of things, like people are watching, they're always watching. And like, you know, I love having different people come through the doors with their different journeys and like figuring out where they need to be and how they need to get there. Because I think it does really ripple. And like, it's disruptive to live this way. Like my students, after they leave my class, the chemistry professor can no longer tell them they don't matter, because that line's not going to work anymore.
The very next class, that's not going to work.
They don't believe it.
They don't believe it anymore.
Let's talk about the chemistry professor. Why is he in that space and saying it? Do you know what I mean? Like, and this is like, I was thinking when you were talking about racism, my dad served on the front lines in Vietnam with Black people. Not in the majority, but my dad was racist and would joke about it, but then would get mad if my brothers or I would get say like, "Dad, that's so racist." And he'd be like, "Well, you know, I'm just kidding." Kind of
thing. I was going to say, was your dad racist, or did your dad continue some racist speech and talk that he grew up with? Was your dad racist?
I don't know. Do you know what I'm saying? Like the dad that was presented to me seemed to be racist, but like he had his own experiences in the society that he lived in, and it produced him same way that you know,
sure,
my dad probably wouldn't care about a basketball hoop, but somebody in his generation in your development might.
Well,
you know, like, and so yeah, it's like
thing is like racism is really a symptom of feeling disconnected or separate,
right?
Right. And so, like, you know, I think that America needs a space where we can collectively care for each other and collectively heal. And
but what if you don't think that? So what if you said that to my dad, he would 100% disagree with you. That, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not looking to be connected, or I don't, you know what I mean? Like, you have to be in a certain space to even be open to these ideas. And that's what part of what we're struggling with in society is that, again, this economy, the money teaches you to be closed-minded. You don't need any help. You don't need another idea. You've got it all down. You've got the good job. You're making the money, and anything that gets in the way of that or doesn't agree with that is not worth the words in the conversation.
Absolutely. I don't know how we bring people here, and I don't know that it's our job to bring them here. They have to bring themselves. And I see myself as just offering a way, if one is interested, to kind of stepping onto the path, right? And then and I've watched my students do this. I have one student that does nothing but origami when I lecture. And they told me, like, please don't be offended. Like, this is how I calm myself, and this is how I hear you.
Yeah, like somebody's biting their nails. That's no different than that origami.
Absolutely, right? Yeah. And so, like, I mean, like, and like, I have another student that like draws on their iPad while I lecture, but it's like the same. So like the way that they take things over and own them and like really use contemplation in ways that benefit them. Right. I think that they're on the path. Right. Like, I don't know. One time, last year, like, my class was super agitated. Like, they were stressed. It was must have been a midterm or something. And so we rented I have to pay to rent space at Kent State. So my students were in the student organization, and they could get the room for free. So we rented a room in the student center. And then they came with towels and yoga mats or whatever. And I did like a 35-minute yoga nidra recording for them. And they all laid on the ground and just like chilled.
Mm-hmm.
And then we talked about it for about 20 minutes and I let them go. And like, I mean, those were the moments that class like really tied together.
Mm-hmm.
And like when they really started making knowledge together, which was amazing.
And the origami or anything somebody might be doing that another professor would see as a distraction, even if it is something that they should let go of, maybe at first it's a defense mechanism, letting them, you know, four classes in, be like, I'm just going to let this go on the down low. I don't need to do this anymore. Giving them the power instead of you put your phone away, your iPad away during my class.
Exactly. Which again is like, it teaches them like they're kids. Like, I mean, that's what I run around chasing my kids about, like, stop playing the Nintendo.
What a beautiful gift you gave them of practicing
any self-care. Yeah.
Well, self-care. Like, I, you know, they might not be able to recognize that they are so stressed that they need sort of a timeout in a way. You know what I mean? Because they're very young and like, but and also probably every other classroom is teaching them that the stress is just, this is just how things are, right? But you're actually like, think about anybody at work. Like, if you're just that high strung in a day, like, you need to take a break, whether that's yoga nidra or a walk or just a few minutes to, you know, decompress somehow, somewhere. I didn't learn that in college. Nobody ever.
Right. And I model the behavior, right? Like, I come in on Mondays and I say, oh man, yesterday I was really overrun. And you know what I did? I just laid on my yoga mat for 35 minutes and just like completely vegged out. And I woke up and I felt like, or I came back and I felt like my battery had been recharged and I was a new human being. It was really an amazing experience. Okay, let's move on to class stuff. Right. And like, you're just like dumping, like, and somebody's sitting there like
planting seeds.
Right. Like, and I mean, the how this all started in my classroom is I just one semester was like, I'm starting this class with a meditation. Gentlemen, one second. Gentlemen, they're video recording this. I'm in a meeting. Please, please.
When's it over?
Don't worry about that.
When's it over? Also, Josh has earphones on, like a headset. So he looks even more professional than our two microphones.
That's what I said when you were on the other link. I was like, oh, you are ready for this.
Well, I mean, and like, so, you know, I model it for him. So the first semester when I thought I was ready, we started the class with a 2-minute meditation. And the first two or three classes were like super awkward.
Oh, awkward.
But then like I had like the dude in the back with like the skateboard, and he like come up and he's like, yo, are we going to meditate again? And I was like,
here we go.
Sure. The best part of class. And then I was getting like army vets would come up and tell me this. I was getting other people, right? And so we eventually moved it to 3 minutes. And so all of my classes start with a 3-minute meditation. And it's unguided, it's just sitting in silence. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of unifying practice. And then I give them this tree of contemplative practices that I sent you in the chat. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then because there's the limitations of me. Like I get drawn to yoga and meditation because I'm not an artist, but I have students that are tremendous artists, right? And so, you know, I just find it, I like the role I get to play, which is basically being a person that they can be safe around, being an adult.
That's a great way to say it, the role you get to play. And we'll post that. That practice tree. Well, with the podcast, I was, you know, what you're saying, the things you're doing are so tiny, but huge. You were saying your first conscious breath was at 40, whatever. I remember not realizing until my 40s, the most wonderful practice that I do every day is to be out in the world and look somebody in the eye and smile at them.
Absolutely.
A homeless guy, the person in traffic, smoking, texting, and, you know, flipping you off at the same time. It is so disarming to people, for one, and you get so much out of it as well. Just nothing. You don't even have to say hello. Just that, like
human contact.
I see you. You matter. You're not just a person in the corner that I'm, you know, you're not a piece of lint on my shirt. And it just changed everything. Just like your meditation, 2-3 minutes in your class. There's lots of different tools teachers use in a classroom. It's seems like such a small thing, and it's a huge wave of change.
Well, I introduced visualization one time to them. They love visualization because they can go into their grandma's home and have the cookies and smell the fire. And they love that one. And you know, the more comfortable they get with themselves, the more they start talking to each other, and then that's it, right? I mean,
now I want a cookie.
And there's so many parallels to teaching yoga and to the community of yoga, right? Like Carla a couple of weeks ago when we were in teacher training was saying, I guess I didn't realize or understand how much I craved community until I was in this community, and it's a safe space, and there, you know, and book club is a safe space, you know, like it's the things that happen both in the studio and outside of the studio that they're just so organically good that it just leads to more good things.
Absolutely. Right. And, you know, I mean, I think sharing a meal with people, right, is incredible, right? You know, Lauren Roberts and I went and had Egyptian food at the Egyptian restaurant in Brecksville. And I mean, I got to kind of take her on a tour of Egyptian food, and we talked about yoga and teaching, and like, it was unstructured. It was just, you know, right? And I think more than that needs to happen. When people eat together, right, they understand they're on the same team, right? And I think, I don't know really how big change is going to happen. All I know is that there are theories and strategies out there that people can live in right relationship to change. And I try to practice that stuff. And so, you know, my teaching, my life, it's all about making more possibilities. It's all about, it's non-hierarchical and decentralized. It's iterative. So we go back and forth. You know, we can do self-study on what we think we know, go back and change our minds. And one of the ideas behind that theory is that all life is fractal. So like, if you want to live a good life, you've got to be doing the small things at the highest level. And if you take care of those small things, it will sort of reverberate out into the universe.
And it's so simple. I mean, we've made things so complicated. It is those simple things that change everything. And the rest doesn't even matter, but it will reverberate out to those.
You know, it's crazy. Like one time, it was this summer. I don't know what the situation was. And I was like thirsty. And I walked over to the refrigerator and I put ice in a glass. And then I opened up the faucet and put water in. And then just like drank the water and was like, this can't get easier. Like, and we don't, I mean, like this is so easy, right? And like, people don't even think about whether the water is clean or not. They just anticipate like it will always work. It's always going to be this way. And I mean, right. And like, it's in these immense moments of gratitude. Right.
And that's a great practice too. Like being truly grateful for the little things like that, of which if you pay attention, there's about 10,000 of them per day.
Right.
Like Joyce, I think this all the time, you know, my car is so old now, but you and I love to drive our stick shift. I love to be able to say, I'm driving the car I want to drive. She might be almost 10 years old now, but I'm so lucky to be able to enjoy driving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you're lucky enough to drive at all or have some old rust bucket, forget about having a car that you want.
Right.
So one of the things that I learned from like disability studies, so these are people that study like, you know, people that lose, they basically make the argument that every single human we meet is either disabled or on the path to becoming unabled. Right. So their hearing will go. Their mobility will go. This will, like, at some point, you have got to be prepared that you may not be able to move. And rather than sort of wait until that moment comes to kind of have to acknowledge all of that stuff in the moment, right? If one understands that, like, we're on a sort of slow path here, that we're not getting back, right? One becomes more open to the idea of being more mobility challenged.
Or right. How do these doors open for me to get in here?
Just because I'm not right now at this present moment does not indicate what I'm going to look like tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. I mean, so, I mean, like, you know, and I mean, these are really big, complex academic discussions. And I'm like basically pulling out like the threads, like, you know, disabled studies say we're all disabled. Black feminism says if we're free, everybody's free because it's bottom up. Like, I mean, these are like the extreme cliff notes of like 25 years of reading this stuff and thinking.
But that's
about
what's
it.
Palatable. Some of us just need a cliff notes quip. Some of us are not going to do that deep dive.
Right.
So,
and this is the role I play in society. Like,
but mind blown, because that is a true statement. Everybody is either disabled or on their way to being not abled.
Yeah.
Amen. And now you're going to have to notice what you can't hear, what you can't lift, what you can't walk to or drive to.
And like, this is a society completely built on mobility. So if you lose your ability to be mobile, you are essentially more isolated, right? Or more separated from sort of community than you're just like one step above from living in a prison.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right. And I mean, you know, I mean, we have people on the street that like the pandemic started. I still haven't seen them. Like they're still just in their house, like looking out the window. And like, it's a tremendously sort of traumatic and damaging way to live.
I actually had a lady call me a couple of months ago. It definitely was either May or June. And she said, I haven't been back since before the pandemic, which we still do have some people who haven't been back. She had bought a pretty big, I think she bought a 50 class pass. And so she has a lot of classes left. And she said, I am just now starting to come out of my house. And I was wondering what kind of preventative measures you're taking because of COVID.
Wow.
And I was like, I didn't say this out loud, but I was like, oh my God, you're giving me PTSD. I'm like, right. we have a very clean studio, but we are not sanitizing walls after every class anymore. We're not
separating people. Yeah.
We're not separating people. We're not spraying things down every 5 minutes.
None of that stuff was working anyway.
Right. We're not keeping doors open. She's like, are you limiting certain classes and how close are you allowing people to be to each other? I'm like, that was 3 years ago. That was 2 years ago at, you know, like that was not last year. Like, are you living in such, I mean, I felt bad for her because it's like, she's living in,
but
such
now it's on her, way. Not on the businesses.
Well, and, but she has, I think an autoimmune disease mm-hmm. situation. So she's at a higher risk, but what's the, where's the balance here? Like you're not living.
That's right.
You can't be if you're Zooming every day, there's
just a risk tolerance.
You can't
equation, really,
you can't really touch or feel, or, you know, there's some energy lost in Zoom. And there's some, you know what I mean? Like you just can't virtually.
It's like that old, again, probably older than the two of you movie, The Boy in the Plastic Bubble. At some point it is, or there's probably a more recent movie that's the same thing. At some point it's more enticing to risk death than to not have human connection.
Well, and the thing about it is that, you know, these people are like stuck in their, no way. You've been seen, bro. Okay. He said, okay. I think that in some respects, right, these people are so isolated, like they can't feel anything, right? They've become sort of paralyzed by fear. The longer this has gone on, the less fearful I am. And I don't do big crowds anymore. I don't do a lot of airplanes anymore. My risk factors are already pretty low anyway, and I just don't test them by making really reckless decisions.
It's just a more mindful life now. It's just a more mindful life in general. Yeah.
But like, do I need to be around? Like, you can't live as connected to yourself as I'm trying to live, and then not want to have community, right? I mean, like, this is the other thing. Like, when we're talking about like me teaching and Brexville, and these, like, the idea that I could teach yoga to my neighbors, like, this is like sacred, right? Like, this is how people are going to interface with me in my community, right? I mean, it's just, I mean, it's a beautiful way to kind of be out in my community, right?
I can't wait. I mean, I think we were talking about this yesterday, like 30 hours left.
Something like that, yeah.
And some other.
Maybe this guy with his history will get the old book report done. That's usually everybody's.
I'm in process.
Last barrier. Like,
I'm in process.
He's just going to hand me his book.
So many people are done with teacher training, but they can't get the certificate because they just balk at that last thing. But that should be easy peasy for you.
No, for me, I've left all the anatomy to the end. The book report I'm writing with ease.
Yeah.
Well, I was telling him, like, a lot of yoga teachers find anatomy the least interesting part of teacher training and teaching yoga. It's so, you need your body, but it's so not about, like,
we don't maybe about the names of the things or
yes.
I mean, to this day, I don't really consider like yoga, like a workout. Like when somebody's like, do you work out? I usually say not really, cause I don't go to a gym and I don't really run like I used to run and I don't lift weights. So I don't do those things. But I'm at a yoga studio 5 to 7 times a week. And, I mean, to me, that's what I need to regulate. That's what I need for me. And anything that happens, bodily transformation or whatever, that's just a side effect
that's a bonus,
the goodness I need. right?
Yeah, thank you for that. That's a really great way of saying it. That's another one that's hard to articulate when, if somebody calls or they have already decided that, you know, this is a workout or what class should I take to lose weight, or do you lose weight from using yoga or from
taking how many calories does this burn?
How many calories does this burn? And then everybody's always surprised when I'm like, you know, even some regular students will say, I don't really burn a lot of calories in power yoga yet. I feel like I'm working so hard. I'm like, it's because you are breathing correctly. And when your breath slows down, you burn less calories. So there's that. Your blood pressure goes down.
Imagine the machine you're honing if you're teaching it to use less energy to do that much work.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's pretty amazing. So I know that that Mary Beth has a class to teach soon. And this particular class likes to show up about 30
minutes early.
And Josh, you've given us over 2 hours now. So I really appreciate that. It looks like your kids are, they need your attention.
One of them's going to basketball here shortly. So that'll lighten things up. And I don't know what the other one's doing. He's doing some sort of yoga pose. That's not yoga.
A couple weeks ago in teacher training, Josh was like, oh, I got a text that one of my kids like fell, face planted at basketball. And he was like, yeah.
But did you die?
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the most beautiful things that has come from my journey is like I got to teach Eli's 9-year baseball team mindfulness. I teach Eli and Noah, both my kids, we meditate together. They're constantly seeing me sort of in yoga poses. I remind them like when they're in the bus, like pretty much our last conversation is, all right, well, you guys have a good day at school. You know where I'm going. And they all go, yoga. So I just like drill it in there in the hopes that, you know, when they have a future problem, it's on the available menu of options to potentially solve, as opposed to the very limited options that I sort of was given, developed, or had when I had to combat those things.
I wish the same for your children and everybody else's children as well.
Absolutely.
So thank you again. And we will have you back in the future, right, Mary Beth? That's Mary Beth's project.
Yes, this was really so interesting for me. It's been a long time since this has just been really interesting.
I really appreciate that.
Love to chat more.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
So if you've made it this far in our podcast, feel free to rate, review, follow, subscribe, tell your friends, share it wherever you can, and come back and listen to the next one. And go back and listen to the previous ones.
All of them. All right, we're done. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you all. I really appreciate it.
Oh, she disappeared.
I'll come back.
There you are.
Come back.
Noah, look, people are seeing you now in your underwear.
No.
Well, Noah, I'm not going to show you me in my underwear. Leave it at that.
I hope we're still recording.
I didn't hear the voice say, recording stopped.